Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. Today, we're going to look at the Gospel according to St. Luke, chapter 24, verses 13 to 35. And this is the story of the two disciples on the road to Emmaus. There's a great deal of buried in this story, but there's also a context to it. There is a suspicion and some scholarly pathways into discovering that there were many stories and many narratives about the Gospels, about the Gospel themes, and certainly about the resurrected Lord. One of those narratives that pre-existed the Gospels was that Jesus, when he rose from the dead, and we've talked about this before, the problem of who is the witness to the resurrection. In one gospel, it's Mary Magdalene, in another gospel, it's Mary Magdalene Mary, in another gospel, it's the disciples. And here, apparently, the first real witness to the disciples are these two disciples on the road to Emmaus. But there was a story that he had first appeared to Peter, and actually Paul in the letter to the Corinthians says he appeared to Simon and then to the rest of us and then to the rest of them. And so there is this tremendous confusion around the very first moments of the witnessing of the risen Christ. And I think we've talked before too about the difference between being an official witness to the risen Christ and experiencing the presence of the risen Christ. Here, there is a presumption in Luke's gospel that the witness now in this particular case are the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, because at the end of the gospel they go back and tell the disciples what they had seen and what they had heard. So anyways, just to know that there is a proliferation of narratives, a great amount of confusion at the time of the resurrection. And I think that even humanly speaking, there was a scripture scholar from, I don't know, back in the 60s, 50s and 60s, maybe, Father Paul Gechter. And he did a lot of work on the emotional and psychological phenomenon of an interpretation of the Gospels. It never gained much traction, and it isn't exactly something that a kind of interpretation that people flock to, but there was some interesting insights in it. And Gechter himself was a Jesuit priest, and he had studied in Vienna actually under Sigmund Freud for a while, and so he was imbued now with the psychological consequences of it all. But I think that we can't apply that into the scriptures themselves, and we can't say, well, this is part of exegesis, this is part of the scholarly and unraveling of the stories of the Gospels. But we can, in our reflection upon it, try in some ways to, in kind of an Ignatian way, to kind of place ourselves into the story. What would our reaction be when, in fact, Jesus had talked about the resurrection several times in the course of his discourse with the disciples, and yet in all of that time they never really grasped what it meant. And we find that in the Gospels too, for they did not yet understand what it meant to be risen, to be raised from the dead. So we can't then light on a particular gospel or a particular narrative and say, well, you know, this is the way it actually was, and the rest of them are kind of deviations from the norm. There is no norm. There is mass confusion at the time of the resurrection. And we gain insights into different pieces of it, different parts of it, through reading the Gospels, and apparently also through other narratives which are not included in the sacred texts. The Gospel actually begins on that evening of the first day. That would be on Sunday. And the disciples were returning to Emmaus from Jerusalem, which they had obviously been there. Sunday was for the Passover. Sunday was the day that they were able then to travel to go back home again, since they couldn't travel really on the Sabbath day. So it says, on the first day of the week, the two disciples of Jesus were on their way to a village called Emmaus, 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they were talking together about all that had happened. Now, as they walked and talked these things over, Jesus himself came up and walked by their side, but something prevented them from recognizing him. We have that same theme again. And the idea that Jesus is present, Mary Magdalene doesn't recognize him in the garden, and now the disciples don't recognize him on the road to Emmaus. This presence that is non-recognizable, I think that we've talked before also, is kind of an analogy to our encounter with the Eucharistic presence of the Lord, that we are not compelled to recognize him. We recognize him through faith and through our relationship with Jesus Christ, that there is no physical compulsion to know who this person is. The same with Mary Magdalene, the same now with the disciples on the road to Emmaus, the same with each of us as we go to Mass and as we have risen before us, raised up before us, the body and the blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, of the risen Lord. In all three cases, the recognition is not compelled. The recognition comes from personal relationship, from revelation, and from the eyes of faith. So that they don't recognize him. And he said to them, "What matters are you discussing as you walk along?" And they stopped short and their face were downcast. That apparently, in their minds at least, the whole idea of the trial, the passion, and the resurrection of Jesus was the big news of Jerusalem over the Passover weekend. And in a way, we can say, well, you know, there was just a small group that managed to follow him. But we have to remember that Luke also tells us that there was quite a crowd that welcomed him into Jerusalem. And we also have to understand, although Jerusalem is a large and sprawling city today, it was not in those days. It was a city for sure, but with a very small population. And something where news traveled quickly. There probably was no one in Jerusalem who had not known of what had transpired. And probably it was a matter of great discussion for them. Was this right? Was this wrong? And so on and so forth. So it was news. And so they're trying to figure out, well, don't you as a stranger even know what this is all about? But then one of them, called Cleopas, answered him. He said, "You must be the only person staying in Jerusalem who does not know the things that have been happening there these last few days." "What things?" Jesus asked. "All about Jesus of Nazareth," they answered, "who proved he was a great prophet by the things he said and did in the sight of God and of the whole people, and how our chief priests and the leaders handed him over to be sentenced to death and had him crucified. Our own hope had been that he would be the one to set Israel free. And this is not all. 2 whole days have gone by since it happened, and some women from our group have astounded us. They went to the tomb in the early morning, and they did not find the body. And they came back to tell us that they had seen a vision of angels who declared he was alive. Some of our friends went to the tomb and found everything exactly as the women had reported, but of him they saw nothing." So here now is Luke's narrative of these disciples on the way to Emmaus telling the story that we find also in the Gospels, that Mary Magdalene goes to the tomb and that with the other Mary, they find the body missing and they are disconcerted about it and they wonder who rolled the stone back, and the angel tells them he is alive, he is not here. And then they rush to tell the others what they have heard and what they have seen. And so some of our friends went to the tomb, and here's the story of Peter and John running to the tomb when John steps aside and lets Peter enter first. And of him they saw nothing. And so what has happened now is that they are confused, and they are, in a way, traumatized because of the empty tomb. The theme of the empty tomb is a very important theme, and certainly here it is a theme. It does not necessarily proclaim a belief in the resurrection, but it is the foundation upon which the witness to the resurrection is based and is founded. I think we discussed once before this idea of there are those who kind of want to dismiss the idea of a bodily resurrection and talk only about, you know, the spiritual resurrection of Jesus, which is not in accordance really with the witness of the scriptures, because the bodily resurrection is critical in the post-resurrection appearances of Jesus to his disciples. So that to try and I think before we said in these pseudo-sophisticated ways, to try and kind of outsmart or outwit the gospel witnesses, the apostolic witness, really is kind of a fruitless endeavor, and it really doesn't lead us anywhere except into a very subjective kind of faith, which doesn't demand that we move outside of ourselves to encounter Jesus as other than ourselves. And this is an essential part of the whole Christian witness. It is not simply an internal phenomenon. It is a phenomenon that demands that we step beyond ourselves. We cannot contain the fullness of revelation. We must step outside of ourselves to encounter the fullness of revelation. And that is exactly what the importance of the empty tomb is all about. It prohibits the subjectification of faith and demands that faith be an encounter with another. We've passed through a long period of time, that kind of has been defined as modernity, I guess, where the whole focus was really on the self. And in this entire focus on the self, there was a tremendous tendency to explore and to become involved in all sorts of intellectual peculiarities. And one of them is this idea of a radical subjectivity to the believing person, which makes faith totally personal and totally dependent upon the interiority of the person and the subjectivity of the person. For we cannot really move out of ourselves to encounter pure spirit. We encounter pure spirit within us. And that pure spirit within us is a legitimate encounter as long as it is grounded and rooted in the other who is not us, who stands outside of ourselves, in whom we encounter. Now, if in fact, therefore, that Jesus has raised from the dead and appeared to the disciples in the flesh, and here again, he is not a ghost. He is not simply a spirit. He is a man walking along the road with the two disciples, and he stops to have dinner with them, and he eats. This is not a ghost who is doing this. This is the incarnate Christ. This is Jesus Christ in his incarnate presence, although his post-resurrection incarnate presence, which is exactly how he remains present to us today, and visibly so in the bread and the wine of the Eucharistic celebration. So at any rate, they are going along, and they are telling him the story of what had happened. And then they're telling him what their expectations had been and how those expectations were shattered. I think we all know the trouble and the problems that expectations can cause us in our lives. Certainly, even in marriages, people who go into marriage with great expectations, which are unfounded in reality, are a formula for marital disaster. And it's the same way, for instance, and many of us, probably most of us in some way, shape, or form, have encountered great disappointments in our lives because we had expected more of something than was there, more of something than we were able to extract from it. And so what the messianic hopes of Israel were at this time were unrealistic. They were the fruit of popular imagination and popular expectation. We've seen before those Jews who did, in fact, expect a Messiah, expected a great general, a great king, Someone who was, it was like the temptations of Christ. What a spectacle it would have been if Christ had jumped off the parapet of the temple and the angels had come and rescued him before the witness of all Jerusalem. Those expectations were not the reality. And those who hung and clung to those expectations were totally and constantly disappointed in the Messiah, as he truly was as he came among them, exactly as the disciples were disappointed in the Messiah, for they never really grasped the whole idea of the Isaian suffering servant as being the one whom they were seeking. Perhaps John the Baptist did, but many, many did not. And most of them thought of a more popular image, a more consoling image. And so what we find now are these disciples, too, dejected because their expectation had not been met. They had not witnessed the coming of the Messiah as they had thought he would be from popular imagination and popular expectation. They instead encountered the scriptural Messiah, the man who emerges from the pages of the prophecies of Isaiah, the one who therefore is the suffering servant, the one who therefore gives his life for his people. They have not yet interiorized that. They have not yet accepted that as part of who the disciples were. So they're telling the story in a way of they're still enamored of the Jesus that they knew. He had done great things. He was a great prophet. He had, in the sight of God and men, he had done all these wonderful things. We had hoped, they say, that he would have been the one who delivered Israel, but obviously they say that didn't happen. Instead, he was crucified. He died. And now a strange thing has happened, they said, that some of the women went to the tomb and he wasn't there, and they went and told the disciples, and the disciples came and they saw the empty tomb. And they leave it with the empty tomb and not with what happens after the empty tomb. And then the rest of this gospel, it takes us into what transpired then. What is this all about? And now, really, I suppose, in a way, the real meat of the gospel begins, because now Jesus is going to explain to them what has transpired and why it has transpired. And so Jesus says to them then, "You foolish men, so slow to believe the full message of the prophets." And here he goes back now, and he goes back and he sinks his teeth into the Isaian prophecies of the suffering servant. And this was not part of the popular imagination. This was not part of the popular expectation. It was instead, now he is beginning to involve them in the Old Testament and how he is present in the Old Testament. It's really interesting. I was reading something the other day, some comments on something where good Catholics were just saying, you know, why is the Old Testament's not important to us? We just believe in the New Testament and so forth. It's something that is resonant of the Zwinglian Reformation in Switzerland in the 16th century, where they pretty much rejected the Old Testament. And in a wave, of course, of 16th century anti-Semitism, and also it is an echoing of the Gnostic heretics of the first couple centuries, who also rejected the Old Testament. They ascribed the Old Testament to be the story of the Deus Alienus, the evil God, the one who created the material world and therefore the evil that is within it. An ancient, ancient heresy that obviously is lurking in the hearts of many good people today, simply because they don't recognize it for what it is, and they think they're being loyal and faithful to Jesus Christ by not accepting the Old Testament. And yet, listen to Jesus himself, "You foolish men, so slow to believe the full message of the prophets, that you might well look forward to the great triumphant Messiah, but you're not listening to what God has said about who this Messiah is going to be. For God has spoken to us through the prophets, and you're totally indifferent to what the prophets are saying. Well, then he goes on to say, was it not ordained that the Christ should suffer and so enter into his glory? And then, once again, he refers to, in the Old Testament, the prophecies, the suffering servant of Isaiah, that there is the more accurate picture of who the Messiah is to be. There is the image of the one whom the Essenes of the Qumran community are deeply exploring and are trying to grasp and understand what all this means. In Old Testament prophecy, because those are the scriptures that Jesus talks about. There is no New Testament, not during this period of time. The New Testament begins to be put together probably no more than 20 or 25 years, and it continues to be put together until the end of the century. So then, after he alludes to the suffering servant, he then, starting with Moses and going through all the prophets, he explained to them the passages throughout the scriptures that were about himself. Now, this is really important for us, too, because we cannot have a full image of the New Testament Christ unless we understand that it is rooted in the expectations, the authentic expectations of the Old Testament, of the Hebrew Scriptures. That even in Matthew's Gospel, in all the Gospels, there's a real intent to show that this is not something radically unexpected if one were well attuned to the Word of God, but it is something that kind of tells us in a sense, what is going to happen. In a way, I suppose we could use an example. It's kind of like in Greek drama. It's like the Greek chorus. It is the chorus first tells us and narrates what's going to happen, which becomes kind of very generic for us. We're not really sure exactly what that means. And then the play fills out the drama, showing you what it really meant in the beginning, but introducing a thematic that is then existentialized and lived out in real life. In a way, the Old Testament is similar to this in its relationship to the New Testament. It was, in fact, part of the whole patristic idea of mysticism, that the secret of the Old Testament was Jesus Christ. Here is a scriptural authentication of that in the New Testament, in the Gospel of Luke, concerning the story of the disciples on the road to Emmaus. It wasn't so long ago that Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI wrote an essay of some kind in which he claimed, of course, that Jesus is in fact the underlying reality of the Old Testament. It, of course, raised a firestorm of anti-Semitism and all the other kind of foolishness that many academics with too much time on their hand get involved in. But if Benedict was anti-Semitic in saying what he said, well, then so is Jesus anti-Semitic in the Gospel of Luke, because he's saying exactly the same thing. And so what we have then, he's telling them all the scriptures about themselves, about himself, and how they could have seen, or they will be able to see more clearly now, what happens. And so as they drew near to the village where they were going, he made as if he were going on. So they pressed him to stay with them. They said, it is nearly evening, and the day is almost over. So he went in to stay with them. Now while he was with them at the table, he took the bread and said the blessing. Then he broke it and handed it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him. But he had vanished from their sight, just as they said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us as he talked to us on the road and explained the scriptures to us? Here again, now, the witnesses, they recognize him in the breaking of the bread. While this is not essentially a Eucharistic celebration, it is certainly a foretaste of the Eucharistic celebration. And as a matter of fact, the Christians are going to come to call the Eucharistic feast the breaking of the bread. So they go back to Jerusalem, and they tell the 11 what they have seen and what he has said to them and how they had recognized him in the breaking of the bread. Here again, the ancient part, the ancient narrative, the ancient story, that the witness to the that the testimony to the risen Christ came from outside of Jerusalem. This is not in anywhere else in the scriptures, except right here in the Gospel of Luke. Is he using an ancient narrative? Does he know these disciples? What is this? Or is this a constructed story in order for us to see more clearly the whole story of the risen Christ? Because this is a place where it is so clearly stated that the image of the living Messiah is that which comes to us out of the Old Testament. So that when in Luke's story of the Annunciation, and even in Mary's Magnificat, there is kind of a dramatic coming to life of Old Testament realities. The Annunciation, Isaiah 7:14, the maiden shall be with child, and the virgin will be with child, and they will say, he is God among us. And then Mary's response is kind of a putting together of a collection of Old Testament ideas and thoughts. Matthew's Gospel, which is very adamant about anchoring in many ways the New Testament into the Old as a sign that it is the fulfillment of prophecy. And so what we have then in all of this is a very clear and direct understanding that the Lord has in fact been presented to Israel from the very first days of its beginnings of revelation. And it's something, too, we might want to think about in the structure of the story. It is certainly altogether something like the Mass. People come, wander, certain disappointment, certain wondering. They encounter the Lord Jesus in the Eucharistic feast, and they hear the Word. And they hear the Word proclaimed and explained. And then they recognize the Lord in the breaking of the bread. And then they go forth and proclaim that Jesus is Lord and he is risen from the dead. So we have here both a story based on ancient texts in some way, a story which gathers up the pieces of the messianic expectation, a story which is a framework for the Eucharistic celebration, and a story which reaffirms the significance and the importance of the empty tomb as an essential component of the story of the resurrection. As we hear this story, this narrative, and as we reflect and pray upon it, let us ask the Lord to accompany us also on our road of discovery and self-understanding and understanding of what God has done for us, in order that we, when we recognize him, may be more than willing to share his presence, the reality of his presence, with those we encounter in our own lives.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
Veni, Sancte.